So I think we were, if you remember, we missed the last class, and we were just started talking about high performance Fortran and Fortran 90. This afternoon we had Gang Cheng's thesis defense when all the gurus were a little cynical about Fortran 90 as being an exciting language. So I wanted to, as we will try to teach you a little bit about Fortran 90, you need to remember, even if you don't like Fortran 90, all the lessons that we have learned in Fortran 90 will be the lessons that we put into any other language, whether it be C++ or Java. And so it actually represents a relatively clean laboratory which essentially focuses on the issues which are central to science and engineering, which are manipulating large data structures, in particular arrays, and operating on such large arrays, issues which tend not to be directly accessible from traditional language, I mean from these other languages. So you may not like capital letters and stuff like that, which is a feature of Fortran, and you might prefer curly brackets to the to what Fortran has, but don't worry, it's still useful. So I believe that last time we finished at this foil here, number 5, which surveyed some important features of Fortran 90, and that's as far as we got. We just went through this list. That's what my notes and computer program says. So now we'll just so what we'll do for the next half a dozen foils is just expand a little on those remarks, although he's still at a rather sort of high level. We will give a more detailed description of Fortran 90 next week. This week, I want to make certain that by Thursday we know enough about high-performance Fortran that we can run programs. So I also have to apologize that in some sense you're guinea pigs. Not only are you, you see, we're tentatively optimistic that we solved the problem with a disappearing image, which was due to a lack of swap space on this particular computer. The other piece you're a guinea pig is that Kiveng Dinsa with Cornell is developing this web interface to high-performance Fortran and MPI, which will be a sort of web-based programming lab, which I think will be quite useful. However, it is not functional. It doesn't quite work right at the moment. So hopefully by Thursday it will work right. And so the plan is that as far as this course is concerned, you can do really what you like, but as far as this course is concerned, all the assignments and all the interfaces with Fortran and MPI will be done through a web interface. This, in the long run, is quite interesting because it will mean that you can have fully electronic courses. You don't have to care about installing things because somebody would have done that behind the web. All right. So, in some sense, so one major advance in Fortran 90 compared to Fortran 77 is that arrays are actual objects. I mean, there are objects in Fortran 90. So in the good old days of Fortran 77, you used to be able to look at the way Fortran compiler arranged storage, and there was variables, and if you had an array which was 100 by 100, there were 10,000 elements, and the next array which was 10 by 10, there'll be 100 elements for that, and that's all there was in memory. As far as, so Fortran 90 is a more sophisticated language. It actually has descriptors associated with each array, which tell the runtime, and of course they're generated by the compiler. They tell the runtime what the array sizes are of the arrays, so that these are that properly defined objects. So it does mean, however, that you cannot assume a simple memory model that you can in traditional Fortran, which allowed you to do all sorts of funny things which are no longer allowed. So we can do operations on full arrays, which we've already mentioned, things like A equals B or A equals B plus C. There are a whole bunch of functions we'll illustrate later on, intrinsic functions like square root and things. We actually illustrated some of those in our Laplace example. Operationally, there's a very important command called for all, which you can view as a nifty way to generate arbitrary functions. So here I've developed the for all, I've written the for all, which this thing here is a plus sign. Here's the for all, which implements the function element-wise function of an array, which sets it to 0 if a of I plus I is less than 0. It sets it equal to the square root of a of I plus I if the resultant thing is positive. So this is just a sort of arbitrary, complicated function, which is not particularly an intrinsic, but it's illustrative of how you can use for all to define sort of complex functions on arrays. And so maybe it's going a little bit of ahead, but why is a for all? For all is different from a do loop. Because a do loop is, if you like, control parallelism, and it just tells you to march through the values of I. In the case of a for all statement, for all is operationally very important, is in a, different from a do loop in a very important fashion, because to do a for all, what you're meant, you're instructed to do is to evaluate the right-hand side of all expressions, all the values of I. So you evaluate all this stuff here, the square roots and the zeros. You store them in some temporary, and then you set the left-hand side, which is here A of I, equal to the right-hand side. So you may seem that seems to be trivial, maybe, but it has the critical feature that it guarantees parallel execution, because it says you take the existing world, calculate something, and set it equal to the new world. And so things like, well, let's give an example. You said A of I equals A of I minus 1 in a for all loop. That would have no dependency, because you take the previous values of A of I minus 1, and then you calculate all of them, and then you set the new values of A of I equal to the set of values calculated with the previous array. And the critical thing which stops parallelism is dependencies between the different values of I. Where, so if the I equals 1 calculates something, it might affect I equals 2 or some other value of I. For all, there's guaranteed to be no dependencies. So it's a different type of, so it's different from a do loop. Now, for all is not in the current Fortran 90 definition, even though many people, including me, wrote sweet letters asking them to add it. It is, however, added to HBF, because it's very difficult to do parallel computing without something like a for all statement. Well, that's what comes of me being so ambitious as to see, that's what happens when I abandon the overhead projector. Now the server's gone bad. Stalled. So this is a different problem from last time. What? This is a server problem. It's stalled. Did you... Well, I guess we have to go back to this. I felt certain we were making progress. So that's why I put these aside. So you might go and find parties outside and tell them the server's gone down. Alright, so so here's a few more oh look, you see it's warming up. Alright, so alright, so here's another few things you can do in Fortran 90. You can access the sections of arrays. Here we have an array U with an arbitrary lower bound, upper bound, and a step. We actually illustrated that in the Jacobi iteration solution as one way of writing it in high-performance Fortran. You can use a where statement, which the arguments of where statements are arrays, and so this allows you to essentially do the equivalent of an if, but an array-wise if. That's what where and elsewhere is. Now, Fortran 77 is a formal subset of Fortran 90. Just MPAC, Clyde. You see, that was good of it. It came up at just the right time, that particular network server error. So Fortran 77 is a subset of Fortran 90. So although they're so-called obsolescent features or deprecated features, which means they're things you're not meant to do, it does support all of Fortran 77, including array element operations. So when we say HPF is built on Fortran 90, it means that if you use the array operations, the compiler stands a better chance of getting a good parallelization, but you are allowed to use Fortran 77 statements. That's a legal part of HPF. It's just not as it's not guaranteed particularly to get good performance. It will depend on the compiler. If you write an array operation, A equals B plus C, the compiler is guaranteed that if it passes the acceptance test to give you good parallel execution of something like that. If you write it as a do loop or something like that as a do loop, it may or may not give you good parallel execution. So we were commenting on the difference between Java and Fortran 90. Fortran 90 was designed in with a standards committee that started meeting in 1982 and reached its conclusions in 1991, a total of essentially 10 years. And it went through an extensive review process. The trouble is, of course, over those 10 years, the It was originally designed for vector supercomputers, but by the time they were debating the syntax of Fortran 90, Cray poured an enormous amount of effort into building very good compilers for Fortran 77. So you now get much better performance on, say, a C90, a typical, the leading-edge Cray machine, by writing in Fortran 77 than you do in Fortran 90. Even though in principle, and if you were starting from scratch, a Fortran 90 compiler for a vector supercomputer should just run extremely well, because vector supercomputers run array operations truly excellently. So this illustrates the problem in writing software. You can have all these best ideas, but if the world moves too fast for you, that's a problem. And so Cray really started working very hard on its compilers in the mid-80s, because they didn't work very well then, and by the time Fortran 90 was clearly accepted, they didn't have the resources to put into making a good Fortran 90 compiler. According to Scott Klasky, it's about a factor of 3 slower, Fortran 90 than Fortran 77, on some of its key codes on the C90. Of course, the other timing issue is that Java has basically got from nothing to where it is in a year. And Fortran 90 went from Fortran 77 in 10 years. Even high-performance Fortran only took 2 years to get agreed to. That was done by a so-called informal standards group, which didn't go through the official international standards mechanism. So that points out that in the area of rapidly varying technologies, some of these formal mechanisms are sort of deficient. Okay. So the server has woken up. We'll go back to if we're optimistic, we'll go back to here. All right, so Fortran 90 has memory management, and you can allocate memory. So you define here an array, arrays U and F to be real arrays which are allocatable, which means they can. You can allocate them at runtime, and then a typical allocate command here assigns space which is dynamically in size. So you can have here an array U, which is NX plus 1 times NY plus 1, and F, which is 27 by NY plus 1, and they're defined at runtime by such a syntax. So Fortran 90 also has pointers. Unlike most other languages, you are required to specify as a target anything that can be pointed to. So, will be described in our more detailed description. That's the compiler optimization issue, which is relevantly important, because the one thing Fortran, at least ordinary Fortran, has going for it, its compilers are much better than C++ and Java compilers. Java, I don't know whether it's off a factor of 10 or 50, but it's off some huge factor in performance. And C++ and C, depending on the application, are off by a pretty large, significant factor. All right. So we should have some respect for optimization issues. Alright, so you can in Fortran 77, parsing arrays and how you cope with dimension statements was always a little tricky. In Fortran 90, you can set up so-called interfaces which allow you to have very flexible calling sequences. So here's an example of a subroutine residual, which you can either call with ordinary arrays, or you could select every other element from the array with one of these section commands, which basically puts a step size of 2, which says step to every other element, and calls such a subroutine. So there's a lot of flexibility in calling, in how you manipulate arrays and hand them to subroutines. All right, so we've seen this type of thing already in our example of the Jacobi iteration. In this case here, we here have an example of U equals scalar fact times U minus AVG, where AVG is another scalar, U is an array, so this takes every element of the, such a command takes every element of the array U, subtracts the number AVG, the average from the array, and multiplies by a scale factor fact. So this is quite elegant. Notice, so I mean this shows that arrays are treated in a very first class fashion. And another, of course, another useful feature of Fortran compared to other languages is that things like complex are again treated seriously, which is a deficiency of most other languages. There are many scientific applications where you do need the variables to be complex, and it's very inconvenient to set up complex as a data structure, because again, that means that complex is somehow treated differently from real, because it has to be a special type of data structure. So here we have various intrinsics, something like square root of A. Here we've taken a section of A, so A 1:100 is another array, is a, whatever the original dimension of A is, a, is an array, so square root of that generates an array of length 100 whose elements are the square roots of the original elements of A. Sum is one of these reduction operators, which returns a scalar, which is just the sum of all elements of A. Size is an example of an array query intrinsic, which tells you, in this case here, the first dimension of A. So the 1 here is the dimension. So if A was two-dimensional, size A of 2 would give you the second dimension of A. Up here we have an example of something we looked at of actually to calculate the average, supposing in the Jacobi's iteration this was two-dimensional. The average would just be the average of the values of U to the left and the right and up and down, and so that's what's done with the C-shift operation here. So 1 is the first dimension, we shift by 1 in the X direction. Yeah, minus 1 in the X direction, 1 in the Y, and minus 1 in the Y. So this third argument of C-shift is the dimension in which to shift, which is in this case either X or Y or equivalently 1 or 2. So these are array operations. They produce a new array which is shifted in the designated dimension by the amount here, this integer here. Right, so that's arrays. All right, so there's something called a derived type, which you would call a data structure or object. So here's a typical type of object you would read in a book on object-oriented programming, but defining people or employees or something. So this, we're having a type called person, which consists of the following subtypes: a character of length 10 bytes of name, a real called the age, and some ID. And then you can define instances of this derived type in this fashion here. So Fortran 90 has object structure in it. It has, there is no inheritance in Fortran 90. It just defines objects essentially, or which I say are called derived types, to be inconvenient. The syntax, of course, just to be difficult, is different from most other languages. I don't know if there's any other language that uses percent as a as to be the member. I mean, this is what most languages use, a dot there, as far as I know. But they use percent. I must admit, I find this the different choices languages use to be very frustrating. Recently, I've been doing a lot of going back between Perl and Java and JavaScript, and I keep using dot and plus incorrectly, because what's dot in Perl for adding characters is plus in these other languages, and that's very frustrating because it's so easy to miss that particular mistyping. We can also define methods in these for these derived types, and indeed you can sort of overload existing operators, so you can define something called the plus operator for these objects or derived types, so u plus me can be defined if you write a suitable operator. There are also constructors that allow you to make instances of a particular derived type. So here we set a constructor for the for this person derived type, which just gives the value of the three entities in it. So Fortran 90 allows you to build nifty things like linked lists. So here's an example of a possible linked list with three sub-entries, of which the last one is the most interesting. It's the pointer to the next element in the list. So this shows the use of the again a derived type, which is going to be an element in a linked list called entry, and the use of a pointer, which is defined to be the same type as, because it's going to point to another element in the linked list. So this is a pointer to something of type entry. So this shows, this is not meant to teach you Fortran 9, this is meant to give you some illustration of its capabilities. So if we set, say, current, which we'd already defined to be of type pointer to type entry, we can say current equals entry, and then we give some new some values, and let's assume that first was the original first entry in the linked list. So this effectively sets a new entry in the linked list, which then points to the original first element. So this adds an element at the beginning of a linked list. Then we just reset the pointer first to be current. So this defines first to be a pointer to current. So again, just to be awkward, Fortran 90 has this explicit assign, when you assign, so to assign a pointer to something, you have to say equals greater than. So A equals greater than B makes A a pointer to B. Okay, so a module is essentially a, if a derived type is a data structure, a module is an object, because it can also have methods. So a module has a name, it contains a bunch of methods. So the simplest module is actually a common block. So if you wish to, instead of using a common block in Fortran 77, you could use a module in Fortran 90. So here's a module which I've called Illustrating Common Block, which I defined to have one, an array of dimension 52 called cards in it. And then if I wish to use that in a Fortran 90 subroutine, I would just say use the name of the module. So that will be equivalent to an include statement. Or just a direct comment statement. Now here's an example I took from the book of Metcalfe and Reed on Introduction to Fortran 90. So this is, if you like, an object or module called interval arithmetic. It has here a derived type called interval defined in it. It tells you that there's an interface to the operator plus, which is going to define an overloaded plus operator, which is going to be defined by the module procedure add under by intervals. And then we define in the method section, which is after the contains, we define this function add under by intervals, which adds to two things of type interval or type interval, and it does it in the trivial fashion by just adding the elements. You add the lower of A to the lower of B, and you add the upper of A to the upper of B. So this is an example of the types of things you can do in Fortran 90. Right, so that's, at this stage, all I was going to do on Fortran 90. We'll give a little more detailed discussion later on. So now we'll move on to a discussion of high-performance Fortran. And probably this time I'll mainly get through the general motivation of high-performance Fortran. After that, we'll discuss basically the data mapping statements, the parallel statements, and some discussion of the extensions. So, so I should say, I will give you these foils. I'll give you copies of all this stuff on Thursday. I apologize for not having it ready. So Ken Kennedy and the colleagues at Rice, and actually other various other people, well, Rice has taken the lead, although other people have made a major contribution to high performance Fortran. And there's been this quite interesting mechanism called the High Performance Fortran Forum, which has defined the language and evolved it in a reasonably effective fashion. And there's a whole bunch of useful web pages which tell you about the language, and you can also subscribe to the various mailing lists about the language. The forum has just finished its second round, which has clarified and slightly simplified the original language and define some extensions. Which I say, the extensions HPF2 we'll discuss later on. So let's just a little step back and just spend one foil saying what HPF isn't. So we already pointed out in the example of Laplace's the various types of models. So we have explicit message passing, which is of course illustrated by PVM or MPI, where the user explicitly breaks the program up into parts, explicitly programs the calls to the message passing routine, and it's these calls which make certain all these various program parts work together to solve a single problem. So the feature of this approach is that it matches the hardware very straightforwardly, but this breaking up into parts is not particularly natural for the problem, because the parts reflect the machine. And if you're running an MPI program on 16 nodes of a parallel processor, you break the problem up into 16 parts, however many parts the original problem had. So if I'm doing a numerical relativity problem with 128 by 128 by 128 grids, breaking it up into 16 parts is quite easy because there are lots of grid points, but it's not natural. So that's the problem with a lot of the so-called object-oriented approaches. So in an object-oriented approach, at least the first approximation in the simpler object-oriented approaches, and this is what you'd have to do if you use Java without any extensions, you would basically write message passing. What you'd notice is that if I go back to my original model of parallel computing of, say, let's look at some of these analogies to masons laying bricks. We can think of each mason as an object with a set of methods which are called brick laying and talking and something. So clearly object-oriented programming is very natural in this area because you can think of each component of a parallel program as an object, which object sends messages to other objects. That's the classic way most objects communicate. However it's implemented, that's how it looks like to users. Users just effectively send messages to other objects. So the problem with object-oriented programming is that if the objects are natural and represent functional parallelism, it's fine. But if the objects just again represent the path that we broke the problem up into, it doesn't really solve the problem. I mean, it still might be better than MPI to have objects representing the parts, but it doesn't really address the issue that the original problem didn't have 16 parts. It had, in the case of that numerical relativity, 128 cube parts. All right. So, the essential goal of the data parallel programming model, rather even more general than data parallel, is to express the problem in terms of, if you like, the objects or the syntax which is natural for the problem. And now for a typical Fortran or scientific problem, that is the shared memory model. Namely, the natural way to think about a grid problem or a particle problem is an array of grid points or a set of particles, and then you have operations on those arrays or operations on those particles. So the natural model for most problems is shared memory, in the sense that there is a single data structure. Shared memory as far as the problem is concerned, because you want to think of a single integrated data structure which holds everything about the problem, and then you have methods acting on that data structure which do things. Those methods and that data structure can be broken up into parts, but that's not how you think about it as a user. You think about the data structure. So the basic goal of data parallel programming languages is allow the user to specify the data structures appropriate for the problem, and then let a compiler convert the data structures appropriate for the problem into the data structures appropriate for the machine. And if you like, the great difficulty that computer science as a field has, it has proven to be extremely hard to find a language which is suitable for the problem, which it is a reasonably easy job to write a compiler which maps it into a implementation which is suitable for the machine. Message passing just doesn't address the issue. It says write in the fashion suitable for the machine. So So I think about 18. So after this stage here, I want to go to a different different foil set. So this foil set here, the next few files are going to elaborate on sort of way I like to describe these issues. We'll have to go through a few, we'll discuss it in little detail. Like in some detail. So this is an aside. We'll insert curly brackets, which is basically an aside on what a computer language is and what it's trying to do, and in some sense, what sort of the underlying logic behind them. All right. So we want to see this file here. We're imagining. And we're trying to sort of abstract what the use of a computer is to model, say, a physical system. So let's think about quantum thermodynamics, which is a fundamental theory, which is here, which is meant to describe the underlying fundamental particles of nature, which are the quarks. So let's assume nature has quarks and gluons. Then quantum thermodynamics is a theory which is basically invented by some brilliant physicists. Now, in order to understand what that theory really predicts or says, it is not possible to do it in pencil and paper. It's too complex, nor is it possible to fully calculate it because it's, again, too complex. We tend to have to make a model based on that theory, which simplifies the world, because we certainly can't simulate the entire world. So given a model, we then invent a numerical method, which in the case of quantum thermodynamics would be a statistical method. Then when we get to the statistical method, we're meant to cast it in a form that a computer can understand. So that's where software comes in. The software takes something which is sort of understandable intellectually up here, which is a numerical formulation of, say, some sort of set of equations, or in this case here, ultimately nature, and is meant to essentially implement it on a computer. So software maps a numerical method onto a virtual computer, or possibly even better, a virtual problem. And then finally, that's what the software the user writes. And then finally, the compiler and the linker and the runtime map that software onto the computer. So up here we have ultimate truth. Down here we have some bunch of transistors. And we see that we get from one to the other with a set of mappings. And if you look at each of these mappings, at each stage, in some sense, at least except possibly for this last one, you throw away information. Because these are, the theory is not the exact theory of nature, the model is only an approximation to the theory, the numerical method is again an approximation to the model. I pointed out many times that when you write software, you throw away information that was implicit in the original problem, because I wrote the problem with Fortran 77 or any sequential language is that it's throwing away information that was obvious in some sense from the original problem, because that information is only contained in the value of runtime variables and is not available from analysis of the software itself. It's dependent on the data. So one of the reasons why it's interesting to think of software as mapping from problems to computers, you can then understand some of these trade-offs in that when we looked at MPI, that was a piece of software that looked like a computer. It was a software model which was like the computer. If you look at HPF, it's meant to be a software model that looks like the problem. So this set of files here make a few more comments on this issue and point out that you divide this mapping into parts. It's also the one thing this particular file emphasizes, which is again quite an interesting general issue, is if you think of these various choices of software, usually the software is designed to optimize something. In the case of, if you take the field of optimizing compilers, you're trying to develop software which produces the highest possible performance. If you take the field of software engineering, it's trying to find some principles that minimize not the performance of the software on the computer, but what's called here the user preparation time. It's trying to make the task of preparing the software easier. So actually software can not only do the mappings at different sort of levels, it can also be designed to solve different issues or minimize or satisfy different criteria. And there is no one criteria, because if I'm doing rapid prototyping, I want to minimize user preparation time, because I'm not going to run the program very much. I'm just trying to get some quick answers. I just want to be able to develop my code very fast. If I want, once I've got the code, and I want to run it for a year to find out what the black hole really looks like, then I certainly want software that's optimized for performance. The difference between 1 year and 2 years is a big thing. But the difference between 2 minutes and 4 minutes is probably not such a big thing. I won't spend much time on this. This is something I do in other classes. There is sort of a general framework I invented called complex systems, which we needn't discuss in detail here, but the idea of this is that you can try to quantify all these issues by noticing that basically software is mapping one thing to another thing. Each of these things I call a complex system. That's actually technically how it's defined by people at the Santa Fe Institute, who sort of invented this idea. A complex system is a bunch of interconnected entities, where those entities are not necessarily something simple, like grid points, but can be some arbitrary thing, which can also change. So a theory of complex systems is a theory of coupled entities. And from that point of view, something like a numerical relativity problem and formulated for the computer is a bunch of grid points coupled for an adaptive mesh. A computer is like a bunch of transistors or a bunch of chips connected together. So both of them are connected objects, and if you think about what we discussed about parallel computing, our goal is to match one set of connections to another set of connections, because we wanted the topology of the problem to map the topology of the computer. So some of the things I like to say when I'm discussing this type of point is that if you, well, I'm sure at Syracuse, you study something called computer architecture, which is the structure of a computer. But actually, problems have architectures as well, which is actually quite similar to computers, and actually quite as complicated as computers. And so there's in my opinion, there's a perfectly good field of study called totem architectures. And in some sense, the goal of software is to express the mapping of problem architectures into computer architectures. And the different softwares, basic software choices, sort of make different choices in that space. A lot of you, or at least a lot of people at Syracuse, work on resource management software, how to load balance or a parallel or distributed problem. Load balancing is the task of taking this map and making it typically satisfy the requirement of minimum execution time. That's what the load balancing is, the task of finding mappings which optimize usually a criterion, usually execution time. Yeah, so. Right, so that's meant to be a comment. So this is a very important comment in that it in some sense says why high performance computing has a problem. If we look at the success of Microsoft is not successful because it produces super high performance software. It is successful because it builds software products that fit into standards and have very little learning time because they run on Windows or DOS machines. So they're constructed according to they're not built on the principle of minimizing execution time. So there's a fundamental difference between the driving forces between the PC and the web software industry, which is driven by standards and reusability and very fast, rapid prototyping capabilities, and high-performance computing community, which is almost entirely driven by performance. There is actually, both of these have good reasons. This is driven by performance because we are going to run programs for years. And so it does matter whether it's 1 year or 2 years or 6 months, because that's a lot of money and a lot of difference between whether you solve the problem or not. And even if it's not a year, even if it's a day, there's actually a pretty big difference between 1 day and 2 days. That could be the difference between a company using or not using it. If they get the answer overnight, they might use it. If they have to wait a day, they may not use it. So performance is very important. But also it is very important to look at rapid prototyping and reusability, because that is probably more important. I mean, there are more applications for which that is important for the ones for which performance is important. So all this foil says, and I'm going to stop here in this set. So what this foil says is, it sort of breaks up this mapping from here we said this numerical formulation of the problem. Here we have the computer. And actually you can think of everything. So we have all these, essentially these set of complex systems. And we have a high-level software system, a low-level software complex system, and actually we have even high-performance Fortran as the example here. So the user writes in high-performance Fortran, he maps a mathematically well-defined numerical problem into a piece of software. the compiler takes that software, maps it into typically Fortran 77 or machine language plus message passing, and then the assembler puts that onto the computer. So here we have this sequence of mappings, and in some sense each of these complex systems has a has an architecture or a structure, and you could and you can in some sense say that one of the difficulties of parallelizing Fortran 77 is that the structure of these system, complex systems describing Fortran 77 is different from that describing Fortran 90, and it is not possible. Whereas it's possible to map this into either Fortran 77 or Fortran 90, you cannot map Fortran 77 in general back to Fortran 90. These mappings are not transitive or something, because these are not one-to-one maps. These are throwing away information maps, because I would view that as a fundamental difficulty with computer languages. You always throw information away. If somebody could come up with a nifty language which did not throw information away, everything would be wonderful. But there, as far as I know, there is no such language. I'm not aware of anything which doesn't essentially throw information away, which cannot be reconstructed in any useful fashion. Let me come to this, back to this one now. All right. So when we were discussing this question of problem architecture, you can use it to make reasonably clear statements about what types of languages and the types of approaches are good for what types of problems. And in order to do this, I found it useful to divide problems into these five classes. There are two data parallel classes called synchronous and loosely synchronous, and then there are three other classes called asynchronous, embarrassingly parallel, and meta problems. So let me just give an example of each of those. So the example that we did with the Laplace's equation, Jacobi iteration, that would be called a regular synchronous problem class, or problem architecture. The reason I'm going through this is this way of thinking about problems allows you to decide reasonably easily whether your problem should work in a particular language. It also is meant to clarify what languages are good at what things and why you need different languages and different approaches for different types of problems. So the classic, this class of problem, which in the case of quantum thermodynamics, which is meant to be not very well represented here, is typified by a totally regular grid. It's synchronous in the following sense. The algorithm on each point is identical. If you think about the Jacobi iteration, the algorithm is replaced every point by the average of its neighbors. So apart from sort of boundary values effects, that's a synchronous algorithm, because the algorithm is the same on each point. So you may remember we discussed SIMD and MIMD computer architectures, and in SIMD architectures every computer element had the same instruction stream. Here I use the word synchronous for problems, so notice this is there's a class of problems where the basic algorithm is apply the same mathematical operation on every grid point. Now, synchronous problems run well on SIMD machines, but also synchronous problems run well on MIMD machines. And that says if you take a restricted architecture like synchronous for problems, they will run well on all computer architectures which are of the same type or more complicated. So they run on SIMD or MIMD and what have you. So another thing I might even be on one of these foils that I like to point out, at least the original simple HPF really only does this class of most of HPF only does this class of problem, because if I do an array operation A equals B, that's synchronous in the way I define it, because I've got say A equals B plus C, and then we think of it in a data parallel fashion, every element of I is doing the same thing. It takes the array, the ith element in B and the ith element in C, and add them together and put it in A. So that's a synchronous operation. So essentially all these array type operations, which are the basis of HPF, are essentially synchronous. But that doesn't mean HPF is a language for SIMD machines. It's, if you like, a language for SIMD problems or synchronous problems. Okay, so what's loosely synchronous? The loosely synchronous are probably the most important problems there are in science. Because what is a loosely synchronous problem is still data parallel. There's a bunch of entities. Those entities start somewhere and then they move, they either iterate or move in time. So they start at time t, they move to t plus delta t, then t plus 2 delta t plus 3 delta t. But why aren't they, what's the difference between them and the synchronous? In the synchronous case, we had identical algorithms at each grid point or each point in the data array. In the case of loosely synchronous, we have different algorithms. So that's what you get whenever you have any irregularity, which you do in any real science. In most scientific problems, because of, say, you're doing adaptive meshes, so that some parts of the problem have different levels of adaption to others. Or if in the case of particle dynamics, some particles interact with 3 particles, some with 25. So they're doing qualitatively the same algorithm, solving a PDE or interacting with particles, but the details are different. If you think about it sort of from a high-level point of view, you will always get loosely synchronous type formulations with different algorithms when you sort of do some sort of description of the problem where you're not looking at the most fundamental element. If you're looking at elements such as nested grids, which have themselves other grids inside them, such objects almost invariably will have different implementations which are not therefore synchronous. So a good example of a loosely synchronous problem is a circuit simulation. If I'm doing a circuit simulation, the different elements of the circuit could be capacitors, resistors, wires, generators, what have you. You can have totally different elements, which would have different models, different inputs, totally different compute times. So that's a classic loosely synchronous problem. So take an interconnected group of things, which things are chosen possibly from different populations with very different descriptions. However, loosely synchronous problems, in principle, HPF if extended should be able to describe, because these are clearly data parallel. Because if I take a circuit and try to simulate it, the simplest circuit simulations are data parallel, because you have all the elements of the circuit. Let's take the one we looked at, simulating Niagara Mohawk's electrical transmission system. So you want to start out at a given time t with a certain set of electrical signals. You want to go to t plus delta t and put all the different complicated things Niagara Mohawk has in that system, look at the inputs it gives and have a model to calculate the outputs. And so it's data parallel, where the elements of the data array are not, however, just heterogeneous. They're not just single grid points. They're, as I said, generators. They're all different things that you make up an electrical transmission line from, transition system from. And loosely synchronous have one very important feature, which is technically very important for parallel computing. They are typically the most complicated examples where the massive parallel is clear. So let's suppose instead of Niagara Mohawk, we wish to simulate the entire national grid with all the linkages between all these grids put together. At least on general principles, without looking into detail, it's obvious that we should be able to use massive parallelism on that, because it has this structure of a bunch of entities which we need to move forward in time, so we can think of, and each of them is going to be locally connected, and so we can think of a communication phase where we can think of taking this data structure, sticking it on a parallel processor with a certain number of elements of the data array on each processor. We can think about communicating information from neighboring processors on whatever's necessary to a given processor. And we have this classic communicate, or the neighboring information. So let's suppose these things are in one processor, these things are in another. The structure of this has to communicate its data to here, this one has to do it to here, that's totally invariant as to the head. It doesn't depend on the heterogeneity. It depends on having a basic model of simulation where you have a bunch of connected entities which are evolving in time. And the future, the value of the entity at t plus delta to t depends on the previous values of other entities at time t. Well, if you have that structure, which is a classic loosely synchronous structure, in some sense you're guaranteed massive parallelism, because they have the necessary structure to be able to set up arrays, set up concurrent computation where the synchronization is done through classic message passing of sending information, receiving it, and then doing the simulation. So this is sort of the goal, if you like, of data parallel computing, is to do this class of problems. So here's my standard example of something which doesn't give massive parallelism. It's actually another way of doing some of the problems in the previous world. So, I mean, having come from England, there was a famous battle in England called the Battle of Hastings, where the English king called Harold was meant to have looked up in the eye, and then an arrow which was launched by the French came down and landed in his eye, and he died. So now, in order to simulate the Battle of Hastings, and if you were a typical military war gamer, you would not use a so-called time step simulation. You would not take all the archers and the pikemen and the commanders at time t and evolve them to time t plus delta t. Rather, you would use what's called an event-driven simulation. You would model this battle as a set of events. Archer number 23 launches an arrow which goes through the air and lands in a certain place. Archer number 25 launches an arrow, blah, blah, blah. And an event-driven simulation is characterized by viewing the world as a bunch of events. The events have times, and the algorithm for executing an event-driven simulation is look at the set of events that you have and find the earliest event and execute it. That will then generate other events, add those other events to the queue, execute the next lowest event, and so on. So that's called an event-driven simulation, which is a very important simulation paradigm. In my model, you can do the Battle of Hastings, which is a problem, either by time-step simulation or by event-driven simulation. Time-step simulation is more accurate. Event-driven simulation is an approximation to the time-step simulation, because if you think about it, it makes no sense to say, here's an arrow, it goes through the air for 25 seconds and then lands, because there might be a tree in the way. And in an event-driven simulation, you do not do that. You ignore such things. You approximate the world as a bunch of events with definite times. You do not carefully simulate as a function of time and see what's happening. you do this, we should save huge factors in compute time. So this is called an asynchronous problem class, and it has no good parallelism because it's essentially sequential. You've got to have an event, list of events. And so this is an example of a problem class which is not there, although the underlying problem is data parallel, we formulate it in numerically in a non-data parallel fashion. Because there is no data parallelism, because we have an event parallelism. Those events are labeled in time. So we map this into a set of events labeled by time. Cannot be parallelized in any simple way. If you look at the work on data on event-driven simulation, which is very important, it's extremely difficult to get in significant parallelism. You've got to use shared memory because you've got to get very low latency communication because it's an intrinsically sequential problem. So, I remember now I'm missing the foil on embarrassingly parallel. So I should, let me just go back and discuss embarrassingly parallel. Embarrassingly parallel is the fourth class, and that's a very important class. So embarrassingly parallel says that there's a class of problems where you break them up into parts, where each part can be run essentially independently because they don't communicate with each other. So a good example of that is financial modeling. Financial modeling is quite, at least aspects of it are very easy to parallelize because in order to decide whether or not to buy or sell your stocks, you average over the future. The future is a set of independent hypotheses. You just run over hypotheses. Each hypothesis is different. You can run each hypothesis on a separate computer. They run to completion, give you an answer. You average over those answers. And so a typical financial modeling application consists of a set of independent computations with some final global average at the end. And there are an enormous number of problems of that type. Online transaction processing is like that. Apart from some minor issues of data integrity when you're updating records, when people are sticking their charge cards into machines all over the U.S., that's embarrassingly parallel because you can process those transactions independently. When I stick my charge card in, the machine can process that independently from one of your charge cards because they're independent transactions. There's only some tiny interaction. So if me and my son both make it, he's not allowed to do that, but if two family members make transactions at the same time on the same account, at least in principle, there's some correlation between them. But apart from this very small effect, that's a tiny, the chance of that overlap is very small, online transaction processing is embarrassingly parallel. And for that reason, it is one of the applications that's used parallel computing for, 20 years, some huge length of time. If you go to an online transaction processing house, it consists of tandem computers or SQL computers, just huge arrays of computers, each of which is essentially running independently on a common database, but they're accessing different elements of the database, so it's independent. So you will find that the largest volume of parallel computing applications are essentially embarrassingly parallel. If you look at a lot of the so-called successful applications of complicated parallel computing you look into, but you'll find they're embarrassingly parallel. They're a bunch of independent tasks. The final problem class is actually, if you like, the one that Gang Cheng discussed this afternoon. It's a so-called meta problem. And a meta problem class is basically a class which is where the problem is a complex problem which is built in terms of subproblems. So alright, so this is meant to be an example of a manufacturing and design environment. So that problem is a meta problem because in order to design a manufacturer product, you need to have one piece of software that models that does the solids modeling, and one that generates the grid, one that does the CFD, one that does the structure, and so another does thermal, another does electromagnetics, etc. So these are all separate software modules, and the whole problem is made up of different modules. Some of those modules could be synchronous, some loosely synchronous, and some asynchronous. So that's summarized in this simple diagram here. So here we have a so-called metacomputer, which is a bunch of different computers of different architectures. Here we have a meta problem, which is a bunch of problems of different architectures. And so in some sense, if you like, the fundamental problem is mapping a meta problem onto a meta computer. In studying HPF, we're studying one type of problem, the very tightly coupled, synchronous or loosely synchronous problem. And as we need high performance on them, we're going to tend to map them. Now, we could, in fact, map that to a general metacomputer, but for performance issues, we'll tend to map it into a tightly coupled MPP, because that's the one that will give us a very good performance. Because when we break up a CFD up into parts, the different parts have higher communication bandwidth than the bandwidth between these parts here, which tends to be much lower. So there's a very important structure. So this is an example of, if you like, why problem architecture is an interesting field. If you look at these data parallel problems, when you break them up, you require very high bandwidth and very low latency for the communication. If you look at meta problems or embarrassingly parallel problems, you need much lower bandwidth, and correspondingly you can tolerate higher latency. So it tends to be that data parallel problems map onto tightly coupled MPPs. Meta problems map sort of component by component onto components of a meta computer. But in general, you can do it in a... You can map a whole meta problem onto a single computer. You can map a single computer, a single problem onto a whole meta computer, and so on. So there are all possibilities are allowed. But there are some features of the structure of both the computer and the problem that make certain mappings more natural than other mappings. All right, so we're going to stop there. Saleh, do you have the homework?